Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. Dear Daughter is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we're discussing whether the Kenyan peacekeeping mission to Haiti should go ahead, given the violence there. Kenyans don't think it should.
There's the general feeling that there's need to solve the internal security issues before we can actually look outside of the country. And Kenyans say that the country is literally sending its officers to unfortunately come back in body bags because they've been able to see the videos that are coming out of Haiti and the threats that are being thrown about by the gangs there.
We're discovering how to tell the age of a sand dune and why we need to know that.
If you've got the age of the dune, you can work out how far it has moved over that time span. And in this case, the dune is moving slowly towards an oasis. In other cases, it could be moving in towards roads or villages, and then there's a problem for the local people.
And what impact can United Nations sanctions against rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo have on the conflict there? It's Wednesday, the 6th of March. First, we go to Nairobi. We're in Kenya, but we're actually talking about events happening across the world in Haiti. The capital, Port-au-Prince, has been under a state of emergency since Sunday. It was introduced after armed gangs freed nearly 4,000 prisoners from the capital's biggest jail. Speaking to the BBC, a former Haitian minister, Matthias Pierre, described what day-to-day life was like there at the moment.
Generally speaking, in the country, nothing is working. There is the state of emergency. Definitely, people are scared to go out because when you have so many people out there armed and creating chaos, you don't know what you're going to get out there. So the best thing when you get in those situations in Haiti is to stay home.
The leader of one of the most powerful gangs in Haiti has threatened civil war if Ariel Henry doesn't step down as prime minister. I know you're wondering why we are talking about Haiti here and now. Let me explain. Prime Minister Henry was in Nairobi last week to cross the T's and dot the I's on an agreement for Kenya to send a peacekeeping mission to Haiti to help deal with the social and political chaos there. Mr. Henry left Kenya earlier this week, but he couldn't land in Haiti due to threats from the gangs. Last time we checked, he was in the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico, where his plane was diverted to after leaving Kenya. I should inform you that Haiti is actually part of the African Union's sixth region, which deals with the diaspora. It was also the first independent black state established during the colonial and slaving era. Ian Wafula is the BBC security analyst in Nairobi. He's been telling me where continuing violence in the country and a legal challenge leaves President Ruto's decision to send a peacekeeping force to Haiti.
The reports that we're getting from Haiti is that the situation is quite dire. Gangs control up to 80% of Haiti's capital. So as we speak, schools have been closed down, business unusual, and also the airports. The international airport has been closed down. And interestingly, as soon as Prime Minister Ariel Henry left Kenya, he was unable to go back to his country, obviously for reasons because the airport had been closed down and also for his security. And there was a whole discussion about his whereabouts. At first, there were reports that he had landed in New York, but as of last evening, that is Monday evening, there was a report that said that he had actually landed in Puerto Rico because his flight had even attempted to land in Haiti's neighborhood, that is the Dominican Republic, but then authorities there reportedly did not allow him to land there out of security reasons as well. So we can confirm that the Haiti Prime Minister Ariel Henry is currently in Puerto Rico as we speak.
Okay, so he'd been in Kenya in order to solidify a deal in which Kenya was going to lead a police peacekeeping mission into Haiti. Just tell us how that agreement came about and whether or not Kenya and the Kenyan police would be able to deal with such a complex and chaotic situation. It's a very dangerous mission for anybody.
Yes, Audrey, and just a bit of background. We start off back in October last year when the Haiti Prime Minister Ariel Henry had put an appeal to the international community while he was speaking to the UN General Assembly, and he said that his country was in need because his government had been unable to deal, rather had been overwhelmed by the gangs in the country. It is at this moment that Kenya offered to lead a multinational support security mission to the country, and this was later supported by the UN Security Council. And Kenya offered to lead the mission with about 1,000 of its police officers. President William Ruto said that Kenya has a history of leading missions in different countries. He was referring to the DRC, he was referring to Somalia. And so he felt that this particular background or experience kind of gives Kenya an edge when it comes to international missions. And therefore, he says that his country is best fit to help what he described as a brotherly nation in need.
Before we go any further, Kenya, let's just take a very quick look first at the Kenyan police itself. How capable are they really of dealing with this situation? They don't have the best reputation inside Kenya, right?
Yes, we have had the Human Rights Watch group and other concerned non-governmental organizations saying that the Kenyan police have been accused of human rights violations, including extrajudicial killings. These are accusations that the Kenyan government and the police have denied. But then there's also the capability. This is just a regular police service that's being deployed. Previously, we've seen Kenya deploy its military for such international missions. And remember that Haiti has been described as one of the most dangerous countries in the world. This is a country where the president was actually assassinated back in 2021 in his home. We've also seen, you know, in Haiti, other missions having failed, including the UN mission that was led by Brazil a couple of years back. They were not able to contain the security situation. And so there have been questions as to whether Kenya can actually manage to handle the situation in Haiti. Even this is beside President William Ruto kind of trying to assure the public that they are ready for this mission, Audrey.
What have Haitians said about this? Did anybody canvass their opinions about whether or not the Kenyans would be able to help?
You know, Audrey, back in Haiti, besides what the gangs have said, that they will not allow an external mission to come and interfere with the internal affairs of a country, the local population, for some of them, they do welcome, you know, this particular mission because they feel as though their lives have been held at hostage by these gangs, whereas others feel as though the current issues that they're going through should be solved internally. And so it's a mixed bag of reactions. I did speak to one of the country directors of an NGO whose identity he did not wish to be disclosed. And he said a great part of the success of this mission will determine whether the local population will support the mission. Because also another thing, Audrey, remember that Kenyans only speak English and Swahili, and these are not languages that are popular back in Haiti. A majority of the people back in Haiti do speak in Haitian Creole. And so there'll already be a language barrier, and that is going to be one of the challenges that these officers are going to face.
What about Kenyans? What are they saying about this?
Since the announcement was made back in October last year, Kenyans have been extremely angered. And every time they keep pointing out that, you know, Kenya has its own issues to deal with. At the time, there was an increase in femicide cases, of which the Kenyan police had been accused of kind of being relaxed when handling these cases. We've also had cases of banditry in some parts of Kenya as well. So there's the general feeling that the Kenyans say that there's need to solve the internal security issues before we can actually look outside of the country. And some have even gone to the extreme, you know, of describing this mission as mission impossible and saying that the country is literally sending its officers to unfortunately come back in body bags just because they've been able to see the videos that are coming out of Haiti and the threats that are being thrown about by the gangs there.
I must ask, what's in it for President Ruto to do this? What's in it for Kenya to do this?
That's a very good question, Audrey, because one of the reasons why the High Court had declined this particular deployment, the judge said that the two countries had not signed a reciprocal agreement, basically saying that, you know, the two countries have agreed on issues that they should back each other on. Up until this point, we know that Kenya is offering 1,000 of its officers to Haiti to help quell gang violence, but we do not know what Kenya is getting in return. But from a global perspective, you know, experts say that this is actually a good look for President William Ruto's government having to take part in international issues. And, you know, President William Ruto actually last week when he was speaking to Prime Minister Ariel Henry, he said that this is a part of his government's agenda to take part in international issues and as well as help a brotherly nation, Audrey.
You mentioned that there was a challenge that was brought by the High Court and the court refused to, you know, sanction it. Is it sanctioned now? Because they did sign an agreement, didn't they?
Yes, that still remains a gray area, because one of the things that the court also raised was the fact that the country's National Security Council, in which the president sits in, does not have the power to deploy regular police outside of the country, but instead they do have the power to deploy the military. So that remains a gray area. And also now questions that people are asking is, does this reciprocal agreement that was signed last week between the two countries override the court ruling? So I would say it's a matter of wait and see, Audrey. However, I did manage to speak to one of the police officers who's been selected for this particular mission, and anonymously, of course, and he said that it's as though preparations are underway because they have been summoned at base and, you know, they're waiting to hear about their deployment date. And during the meeting between Prime Minister Ariel Henry and President William Ruto, they both agreed that this deployment needs to happen soon. In fact, President William Ruto said that the events that we have seen over the last couple of days in Port-au-Prince, the capital of Haiti, actually show why this particular deployment is important and needs to happen soon so that, you know, the gangs can be pushed back.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Awesome. Thanks, Audrey.
Ian Wafula in Nairobi. In our next story, we are pondering just how effective United Nations Security Council sanctions are on rebel groups in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The leaders of six armed groups are being sanctioned as violence surges in the northeast of the country. Leila Mohammed, a senior journalist with BBC Swahili, who's been working closely with security forces in the DRC fighting rebel groups, explains who these armed groups are and what they want.
Did you know that there are over 100 active armed groups spread across North and South Kivu and Ituri provinces in eastern DRC? One significant group is the powerful M23 movement, formed in 2012, which has engaged in battle with the Congolese military, recently threatening Goma, the capital of North Kivu. The group claims to protect the Tutsi community, accusing the government of allowing ethnic cleansing against them. The Congolese government accuses neighboring Rwanda of arming this group, a claim Rwanda denies. Recently, the United Nations imposed sanctions on key figures of the M23, including Major Willy Ngoma, the group's spokesperson. Additionally, the UN has sanctioned two leaders of the Allied Defense Forces, ADF, an outfit active in the region with close ties to Uganda. These leaders are accused of causing death, destruction, and human suffering. Both Congolese and Ugandan troops are actively pursuing ADF leaders and fighters. Another armed group active in the region is the National Coalition of the People for the Sovereignty of Congo, CNPSC, formed in 1998. Its Secretary General William Amuri is also listed by the United Nations, accused of supporting individuals and criminal networks, destabilizing the DRC and exploiting its natural resources. If I were to sum it up for you, these armed groups cause chaos, driving millions of Congolese people from their homes, perpetuating an endless cycle of violence and turmoil in the region.
The eastern part of the DRC has long been violent and unstable. This persists, with civilians enduring the brunt of the violence. But will these sanctions make a difference? Fred Baume is the executive director of Ebuteli, the Congolese Institute on Politics, Violence and Governance. He began our conversation by explaining why the UN imposed these sanctions.
So currently there is a new fight by M23 since February around the city of Goma, and there is a popular demand for actions against people who are responsible for this human rights violation and for the conflict in eastern DRC, and also actions against their supporters. I think that is one of the reasons, but also the UN Sanction Committee follow actually sometimes the recommendation of the group, UN Group of Experts, which in this case also name people and how they are, what can be their role. So I guess this is that is also one of the reasons why we can see some of those who are sanctioned.
And what kinds of sanctions specifically are there? Are they travel bans, freezes on people's bank accounts? What are they? And how effective do you think it will be?
There is a set of UN sanctions in Eastern DRC that goes from travel ban to asset freeze to arm embargo on M Group. I think for the specific individual, it must be mainly the travel ban and the freeze of their assets. But I guess for their group, other type of sanctions that are planned are in the toolkit of the UN may be applied.
I ask, how effective will they be? Because I'm just wondering whether any of the people that are involved, I mean, would they be traveling to holidays, say, in Spain or going to the US or anything like that? Or are these measures largely symbolic almost? I don't want to say useless, but symbolic.
Well, I think the reality is that for the people who were sanctioned, this is mostly symbolic. So some of these people belong to armed group who have been operating in the region for years. Some of those group were, like M23, were at some point defeated and now restarted to fight. So this sanction, as well as the past sanctions against members of these groups, were not able neither to constrain them and their group to reject violence and abuse and exploitation. They were not also able to actually push them to on the negotiation table in time. And I think even the symbolic message of this sanction is weakened by the lack of comprehensive strategy around the sanction. So, as you were mentioning, to freeze the asset and to impose travel ban on someone who live in remote area in Masisi, Ruchuru, or in South Kivu would barely affect him. And especially the movement of these people, some of them mainly in the region, Uganda, Rwanda, and Eastern DRC, and I suspect those countries may not be willing to actually implement those sanctions. So to say the least, these sanctions look more symbolic in their format, but in reality, and without any strategy behind, they are highly ineffective.
Is there a case that you might have been looking at where these sanctions have actually worked and they have actually made a difference to the conflict on the ground? And if you have examples from further than the DRC, it would be interesting to hear what you think.
So there are conditions for sanctions to be effective. I think they have to target people or countries or region or situation where who has some dependency from outside. If you freeze the assets, someone has to have those assets or willing to have those assets in the future. They have to be coordinated with additional measure, whether it's military pressure, whether it's peace process or the mobilization process, so that they contribute to some sort of solution. Then they have to be also combined with diplomatic pressure. So I don't know an example outside. I'm sure they are out there, but they are even within the context of DRC, according to some research, sanctions imposed to armed group at the end of the wars, around the end of the transitional period in 2005, 2006, were more effective in sense that they were not only isolated sanctions, but they came along with an intense diplomatic attention around the DRC peace process and electoral process that was relatively fair and offer an alternative to those who were joining armed group. And they came also together with the mobilization process and the reform of security sector. So it's actually built around the strategy. Today, what we are seeing in Eastern DRC is that the UN is taking those sanctions, but at the same time, for example, other actors who could have reinforced those sanctions are not actually following. At the same time, the UN is taking sanctions, and at the same time, the European Union is providing support to Rwanda, which is accused of arming those armed groups. At the same time, the UN is taking sanctions against some armed group in Eastern DRC. The Congolese government is also providing munitions to other armed groups to fight. There is a vacuum in terms of comprehensive strategy around the sanction, and that makes all these sanction policy difficult to be effective in the context of DRC. It will require a lot of work for the UN and from different countries to make sure these instruments can continue to be relevant.
That's Fred Baume, Executive Director of Ebuteli, the Congolese Institute on Politics, Violence and Governance. We're going to Morocco now, to the Sahara Desert, where we see impressive structures looming from the sands, sculptured by the wind. These are sand dunes, and scientists have for the first time calculated the age of one of the most impressive of those dunes. It's called Lala Lalia, a sacred space for the people who live there. Curious scientists have been wondering how old that dune is and what it can tell us about the Sahara. We were curious too. So we invited one of the professors who've been studying the dune to come into our studios to tell us more.
My name is Professor Charlie Bristow. I'm a professor of sedimentology at Birkbeck, which is part of the University of London. I work on sand dunes and all sorts of other types of sediment, so like beaches and rivers.
How would you describe what a dune is and what a dune does?
Okay. The simplest definition of a sand dune is that it is a pile of sand that has been shaped by the wind.
A very big pile of sand.
Yeah. In the case of the one that I'm studying, it's a very big pile of sand. This particular one that we've written a paper on is 100 metres high and about 700 metres wide. So it's a very, very big pile of sand.
Have you seen it?
Oh, yes.
Been through it?
Yes. I've been going there for about 15 years. So first went there in 2008.
Why did it catch your interest?
Firstly, it's a very large dune and it stands out in the landscape. And secondly, when we looked at this particular type of dune, which is called a star dune, there's not very much literature about it. So how they evolve and how they form and how old they are, these were all questions that we didn't really know about. So I wanted to start investigating star dunes. And this one, because it's in Morocco, it's relatively accessible.
Why are they called star dunes?
They're called star dunes because if you look down from them from the air, they have a radiating set of arms that sort of go out, so sort of like a star pattern. Around the edges of the Namib Sand Sea, where the wind's more complex, and you get three or more different wind directions, then the morphology of the dune gets more complex.
So you can actually see it sort of changing shape and form as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. They change in response to the wind. So where the winds are more complex, then the morphology gets more complex. And we get these star dunes where you've got three or more different wind directions.
Where do we find dunes?
The vast majority of them are in deserts, all across the Sahara, from Egypt, right the way across the Sahara through Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco.
So what's special about the ones that you've been studying? Lala Lalia, I believe, is the name.
This particular one, the name was translated to me as being a high sacred point. So in the pre-Muslim times, families would go up there and have a little picnic and a local celebration. And there was a shrine on the back of the dune. Very informal, and it's a very dominant feature in the landscape because it's a tall dune that rises up almost like a pyramid. I mean, it's sort of really pointy at the top, and so it's a very impressive landform. To me, from a scientific perspective, as I said earlier on, there was very little known about star dunes, how they're constructed, and in particular, how old they are. A colleague of mine, Jeff Duller, has been using optical dating to date the age of the sand. So I went out there and with the help of students, we collected a radar profile across the dune, which allows us to see the layers within the dune. And then from those layers, we can tell how the dune has been built up. And then we take samples of the sand, and then Jeff will look at them in the lab, and he can tell how old they are in terms of how long they've been buried in the dune.
And how can you tell that?
So he uses a technique called optical stimulated luminescence, and you shine a laser onto the grains of sand, and this makes them glow very, very slightly. And the amount of time that they've been held in the ground, while they're underground, they get a small dose of radioactivity. And that radioactivity controls the amount of glow that the sand will have. So they can work out, based on what the radioactivity is in the environment, and also the amount of luminescence, that glow that they get out of the sand, they can tell how long it's been buried.
So this dune is how old?
900 years.
Not 13,000 years?
No. It was only 900 years.
So where does the 13,000 years come
from?
Okay,
so these are the layers of sand underneath the dune.
Ah, that are going to become the dune later on.
And there was a big gap. So between 9,000 and 1,000, there was nothing. There was nothing preserved in that. So it's 8,000 years. So you've got sands that are 13,000 years, 10,000 years, 9,000 years.
Nothing. And then nothing.
Big gap. Hmm. No, that's not so surprising in that we know that 8,000 years ago, the Sahara was a lot greener. There was a lot more rain and vegetation. So when the Sahara was green and there was more rainfall, you'd have more plants growing. Those plants would trap the sand and effectively stop the sand from moving. The dunes were there, but they were covered in grass, so they weren't moving and accumulating real sediments. So then the rain slows down, the plants die off, the sands start moving, and then the dunes can start building again.
So what do we do with this information? How does it help us?
If you've got the age of the dune, you can work out how far it has moved over that time span. And most dunes are moving, they're migrating. Some of them are going to be migrating towards villages and infrastructure. And in this case, the dune is moving slowly towards an oasis. In other cases, it could be moving in towards roads or villages. And then there's a problem for the local people.
It wouldn't have escaped your notice that Dune 1 and Dune 2, major blockbusting films, are on the circuit right now. Have you seen them?
I saw Dune 1.
So do people actually connect and ask you questions based on that?
They are at the moment.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's been a happy coincidence that these papers come out at the same time as Dune 2.
And what do you tell them?
I enjoy the movie as a movie, as entertainment. Mm. I mean, I have seen some criticisms that they kind of move from one type of dune to another type of dune.
Which would be on a completely different part of the continent or the planet.
They were, yes.
Okay.
In Dune 1.
Did you pick it up?
It maybe might upset one or two purists, but I'm not too bothered. I think it's just great to see dunes on the movies.
They were talking about dunes. You're fine.
Absolutely.
It wasn't a lecture that you were giving.
Exactly. I mean, they're talking about dunes. That's got to be good for me. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I've been very interested in talking about dunes with you as well. Professor Charlie Bristow, a sedimentologist from the University of Birkbeck. Focus on Africa was pulled together by Alfonso Daniels, Lola Schroyer, and Bella Hassan. Sunita Nahar was at the head of the team. Johnny Hall was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.
As we mark International Women's Day, discover two podcasts from the BBC World Service, celebrating women around the world. Where to Be a Woman is the brand new podcast exploring in which countries women are living their best lives.
And my award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for season 3. Join me, Namulanta Kombo, as I update my handbook to life for daughters everywhere.
Search for Where to Be a Woman
and Dear Daughter
wherever you get your BBC podcasts.